This is a CBC podcast.
It's just one motion in, down at the line, scrape off the mortar, and move on to the next brick.
It makes me think of a layer cake. When I watch the mortar come squeezing out, I think about when I put the next layer on the cake and the icing sort of starts to come over the edges.
Right, right. The longer you do it, the better you get it. But to do it quickly and to do it really well is truly an art. I mean, if people didn't know it, Winston Churchill used to lay bricks just to relax.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and there is definitely an art to it, to see people that can do it very quickly and very well.
Fixing the housing crisis depends on people like Dave Mulcahy. By one estimate, Canada will need more than 1 million more construction workers in the next decade to get the necessary homes built. But getting people interested in doing that work can be tough. I'm Catherine Cullen, and this week on The House, housing. The federal minister on Canada's brand new national strategy. Alberta Premier Danielle Smith on her plans to stop the federal government from dealing directly with cities. And why some construction workers say they're worried. Plus, Canada's former top spy on how the Prime Minister gets briefed on intelligence. Does it matter if Justin Trudeau isn't reading all his notes? And Conservatives gather in Ottawa talking about everything from immigration to climate change and defunding the CBC. What can those conversations tell us about Poilievre policy? But first, Canada's new housing strategy. Can it solve the problem? The House is now in session. Part of how the federal government wants to fix the housing crisis is doling out billions in housing infrastructure money for sewers, wastewater, and more. The federal government says it will give that money to the provinces if they agree to certain conditions around zoning and building code changes. If not, the federal government will skip over the provinces and work directly with municipalities. But Alberta Premier Danielle Smith is saying not so fast. This week, she announced legislation that would give her government final say in any federal funding coming into her province. For housing, certainly, but municipalities, schools, and agencies need provincial sign-off, too. So, what does it all mean for getting houses built? Alberta Premier Danielle Smith was in Ottawa this week, and she joined me in studio on Friday. Premier Smith, welcome back to the House.
Hello.
Why does your government feel it needs to be in control of the federal funding that's coming into your province?
Well, look, I mean, we just want the same treatment as Quebec. I noticed in their announcement, they said that they recognize and respect the unique approach required for investing in housing and infrastructure in Quebec. And what Quebec has done is they passed a bill that says that you can't do a workaround. You can't go to the municipalities. You've got to deal with them directly. And they were one of the first to get a deal back in November. And now they're well on their way to building out their housing infrastructure. And I just think that if you're going to treat one province that way, you should treat all provinces that way.
I'm not sure that tells me what is it you think it would add if they had to deal with you and then you had to deal with the municipalities.
Well, I can tell you, we already have established relationships with our municipalities. We have 350 of them. I've been to a good share of them in my time in politics as well, and I doubt very much that the Prime Minister or the Housing Minister could say the same. I know what the issues are with our municipalities because I speak at their annual conventions year after year. There's a mid-sized city group that also I meet with regularly, and so we have that established relationship. And because they don't know where the need is. And that's very obvious by the announcements that they made. They made one announcement for Edmonton, one for Calgary, one for six small municipalities, and they've left about 350 municipalities out in the cold. And that's just not fair.
Now, I know you were talking to some of your provincial counterparts. You had a phone call just this afternoon. Are any of them at the place where you are? Are they going to follow your lead and table some legislation soon?
Well, all I can say is that when I found out about this legislation at the last COF meeting that we had, and the Canadian Affairs Minister, I think is what they call him, was kind enough to print it off for everybody so that they could all take it away. But
this
if you
is
look
the
at,
Quebec Minister. Sure,
if you look
you?
At the, if you not Legault, he was his Canadian Affairs Minister. But if you look at the approach that we took in the last announcement after our last COF meeting, all of our premiers said the same thing, that the federal government should work collaboratively with the provinces in areas of provincial jurisdiction. So I think that that has been influential. That's our expectation as provincial premiers. And unfortunately, the only one they seem to be doing that with in a consistent basis is Quebec. And it's because Quebec has this legislation. And so I'm following suit. I don't know if the other provinces will as well.
Now, the Prime Minister was asked on Friday about your legislation. I want to play you a little clip of what he had to say.
We heard from a cavalcade of premiers saying, see, the federal government needs to step up more, needs to do more. It's trying to get out of the business of housing. The federal government needs to step up and fix this housing crisis that we've seen across the country. So we are. Provinces should be careful what they wish for. They want the federal government to fix this housing crisis? We are.
Be careful what you wish for. What's your response to the Prime Minister?
I wish he would treat us exactly like Quebec. And I don't think that that would be something that I would be careful of. I think that that is something I would expect. The other part, too, is that we have been doing our own actions on housing. I would hope that the federal government would partner with us, but I certainly wasn't expecting it because it's taken them months, if not years, to recognize that there's a problem. We can't sit around and wait for the federal government to prioritize something. And so we've already engaged with our municipalities on reducing red tape. We are already working with them on an $840 million three-year affordable housing plan. We're working on attainable housing by reducing a variety of restrictions. So I would say that that many provinces, ours included, had to act because the federal government wasn't. And if they want to accelerate the work that's being done, they should give us a call and partner with us rather than work around us.
Well, on that front, part of this new national housing strategy is this Canada Builds program, right? Loans up for grabs. Provinces, though, also having to put money on the table. It's modeled after what happened in BC, and I know you're very interested in the fact that BC got $2 billion in loans and financing. Sounds like the money is on the table now, but it's going to require provinces to put their own money on the table. Will you pursue this funding?
As I said, we have $840 million over 3 years that we're already putting forward to spend on this. We have a number of other proposals that are coming forward. We have a process that we have to go through in the legislature before I can reveal the details about that. But my housing minister has been in touch with the federal housing minister to say, how can we work together on an arrangement this way? And so I would hope that we would be able to do that, because I think that that's what our municipalities are looking for. They don't want to have to hire a whole team of lobbyists and grant writers and spend a whole pile of time to try to scrabble after money, hoping that they've hired the right lobbyists. They believe that they should be able to work with the provincial and federal governments together so that all of us would be able to identify the need and so that we have some fairness.
One thing that you have said you were not particularly happy about in this federal announcement about the infrastructure money is this language around things being climate-friendly housing. Calgary Mayor Jody Gondek said earlier this week that she worries you're going to let your concerns get in the way of important funding. Let's listen to a bit of what she had to say.
The funding that's being offered for housing has a lot to offer. However, the provincial government has gone after one specific thing, and that has to do with net zero. And so if they will get hung up on net zero on every type of contract that we're getting into, that's a problem for me. I want to make sure people have housing. That's priority. And everything else that comes along with it needs to be negotiated.
Why is climate-friendly housing a problem?
Oh, wow. Well, look at what climate-friendly electrical grids look like. We've got a federal government asking us to be net zero by 2035 and essentially demanding that we build solar, wind, and battery to the exclusion of everything else. That would cost us, we estimate, somewhere in the order of $200 to $400 billion to upgrade our power grid. That's why, because you have to have affordable housing. That's what this is all about. It's not a matter of adding $20,000 or $40,000 or $60,000 to the cost of a home to achieve a climate agenda. It should be about affordable housing so that those who have entry-level housing have the ability to enter into that market at an affordable level. That's what we're worried about, is all of the additional measures that are going to elevate and escalate the cost of housing and miss the point. The point is attainable housing.
Can you point to anything that the federal government has said that gives you evidence that this would be net zero housing, or put the kind of conditions that you've talked about? I know you've said you're worried that homes won't be able to have natural gas hookups. What evidence do you have that they would go that route?
Well, look up their net zero housing strategy. I mean, Stephen Guilbeault was pretty clear a year ago when he started consulting on an emissions cap, a methane cap, a fertilizer cap, the net zero cars, net zero power grid. He had net zero homes in there as well. And I think what happened is...
But this doesn't say net zero, right?
Well, I would have to take it all in a part. I mean, if he's willing to, if he was willing to be reasonable on any of those other policies, then I would trust that maybe in good faith they wanted to work with us on truly building affordable housing. But the fact that everything comes down to achieving unachievable net zero targets within a compressed time frame, what I do know is that costs money. Lauren Gunter, one of our columnists in Alberta, did an assessment of the cost of this program in Vancouver. And it was costing $1.5 million per unit to build. I don't think anybody looks at that as affordable housing. We need to make sure that the program is building more housing so more people can attain it.
I take your point about affordability, and we will ask the federal minister about that in a moment. But Mayor Gondek is saying, you know, we need this money. If she wants the money and she is okay with the conditions, why would you step in the way of that?
As I said, we are not going to get in the way of any existing agreements, but we have an expectation on a go forward when this legislation passes that when the federal government engages in an area of our jurisdiction, that they'll work with us.
But this is an agreement that is yet to be made. So your message to the city of Calgary is, even if you want this money, if the deal is that there's some sort of net zero or there's just like too many environmental demands, they can't have the money, or the federal government has to back down?
As I said, they've already announced the arrangement. We're not going to stand in their way. My concern is that we have 350 municipalities that have been left out in the cold. And Alberta contributes more to Confederation than virtually any other province on a per capita basis. We should be getting back a per capita share. It's not fair to pick winners and losers, and it's not fair to shortchange Alberta taxpayers. And that's a role that we're going to play, is to make sure that those dollars come back on an equal per capita basis.
Will you be reviewing the housing accelerator deals that are already in place? You said you will review. Okay. If the federal government does say, okay, you know what, we can't come to an agreement here, this money is not going to flow, is your government prepared to replace that funding? Because we all know these houses do need to get built.
We're prepared to take them to court. They cannot be using their federal spending power in asymmetric federalism. There is a constitution that requires them, I believe, to not only exercise their spending power in their areas of jurisdiction, but to not be playing politics with this kind of money. And so we'll either see them at the bargaining table or we'll see them in court. But we will not stand by while they continue to treat Alberta municipalities unfairly.
Okay, we are out of time. Premier Smith, it was really nice to get to talk to you today. Thank you.
Talk to you again.
Alberta Premier Danielle Smith. So how does the federal government respond? Sean Fraser is the federal housing minister. Welcome back to the House.
Thanks for having me.
We just talked to Premier Danielle Smith. She has put a pretty big roadblock in your way with this legislation, saying you have to go through the province to hand out this housing infrastructure money. She's threatening to take you to court if it becomes an issue. How are you going to get around that?
Well, look, it's a little ironic because the policies that we're talking about rolling out actually contemplate in the first instance bilateral deals with provinces, both when we're dealing with infrastructure funding that's going to enable home building and additional components that will allow us to partner with low-cost financing that we can run through provincial entities to support home building. We're only talking now with these particular programs about going through cities if provinces refuse to implement policies that are going to make it easy to build more homes and frankly, reduce the cost on municipal taxpayers when it comes to managing infrastructure. You know, Alberta, I lived there for 5 years, and one of the things that people believe in is property rights. We want to incentivize decisions that allow people who own a piece of property to build a home on their own property that can provide space for another family if they choose. We're not forcing anybody to, but I think families should have that freedom. If Alberta wants to add a layer of bureaucracy to approve funding decisions by the federal government, they're within their rights to do so. It will slow things down. But if we can work together, we can have Alberta step up to the table with investments and policy changes that will make it easier to build homes. I expect we're going to be able to reach a partnership that will achieve our common objective of getting more homes built for Albertans.
The concern for Danielle Smith has to do with those conditions, specifically on this housing infrastructure money. There's a line when your government sets out the conditions where you talk about climate-friendly housing. And she says, I'm worried that that is going to be net zero housing. I am concerned that the federal government is going to not allow natural gas hookups, for instance, and that it's going to cost people a lot more money. So, first of all, is there a scenario where you would require that some of these houses be net zero, where something like she's describing, where natural gas hookups wouldn't be allowed? Is that something you would contemplate here?
Look, that's not what we're talking about, and I'm not sure where Premier Smith is gathering that perspective. What we're talking about is reforms to the National Building Code that are going to make homes more efficient so we can reduce the emissions. And on the concern around making things more expensive, this is ironic because when you actually make your home more efficient, you pay less in your power bill every month. In my home province, when people transition from home heating oil, which many rural communities in my region do, and they transition to a heat pump, you can save between $1,500 and $4,700 a year, depending on the efficiency of the home that you have. So our goal is to certainly reduce emissions through efficiency with home design, but also to ensure that we're saving people money. Those are things that I think most people in Canada agree are important priorities, and we're going to do what we can to help address the very real threat of climate change. At the same time, we try to save people money on their power bills every month, and I would hope that the province of Alberta and frankly every community across Canada would agree with us on those pursuits.
Another part of her argument, and this is a bit more around the housing accelerator money where you've made these deals with different municipalities across the country, is that a province knows its municipalities better, and right now too many municipalities, smaller ones, medium-sized ones, are being left out. What do you say to that?
Well, the irony with that argument is that the reason the Housing Accelerator Fund came to exist was because provinces weren't taking action to actually give people who own property the freedom to build homes for their neighbors during a housing crisis. The kinds of reforms that we have seen communities, big and small, implement through the Housing Accelerator Fund largely could be done at virtually no cost by provincial governments should they choose. Now, if provinces are taking the position that they don't want to implement pro-housing reforms, then that's a different challenge that will result in Canada not being able to solve the housing crisis, not because the federal government lacks ambition, but because provinces would be getting in the way of the kind of reforms that we actually need to implement. We're not talking about fundamentally changing the character of communities. We're talking about creating space for people who need to find a home that they can actually afford. With the Housing Accelerator Fund, we actually found a very quick way to reward the most ambitious municipalities when it came to the reforms that they were going to implement by creating competition. And it bypassed the need for a bureaucratic approval by a third level of government when we work directly with cities. I know Minister Nixon has expressed concern before about Alberta getting its proportionate share. Under the Housing Accelerator Fund, Alberta received within 0.03% of its population share. We funded communities right across the province, represented by multiple political parties. If they wish to slow down the process because they want to have some agency over this, I would suggest they do what Quebec did, match us in funding and implement reforms on a province-wide basis that will allow us to achieve our goals. Those kinds of deals are on the table, but we want to make sure that we discharge our responsibilities to treat Canadians' money with the same respect we would treat our own and get a good deal for that money.
I just want to be crystal clear about something you said there. Match us. You talked about a Team Canada approach. You want provinces and territories to match your ambition. Match your ambition is another way of saying match our money. What you're really calling on them to do is step up the funding beyond what they're already doing.
Now, that's going to depend on the specific policy area. In some instances, funding is the bottleneck. But when you do have restrictive zoning policies that prevent people from building homes where infrastructure already exists, you're also limiting solutions that don't cost anything. We want to see them to match the level of investment, certainly across certain programs. But in others, we want them to match our policy ambition. If they want to contribute public lands and public money the way the province of British Columbia did to achieve a deal through the BC Builds program, we're creating that opportunity. If they want to match not only funding through infrastructure investments, but the policies that will allow us to reduce the cost of infrastructure by allowing more homes where infrastructure already exists, then I think we're in the game. But if we don't see provinces putting their resources on the table and implementing policy changes that are purely within their jurisdiction to deal with, then it's hard to make an argument that we should be dealing with jurisdictions that are refusing to implement the policies that will deliver the outcomes the funds are meant to deliver. This is about building homes for Canadians. It's not okay. Nobody I talk to wants to hear politicians fight about jurisdiction. They want us to work together to solve problems, and that's what we're going to do.
Okay, let's talk about another piece of your strategy, the question of labor, having enough people to build all these homes. The estimates range between 500,000 to more than 1 million additional construction workers who are going to be needed to build all the homes we require in the coming years. I want to put our conversation on pause for a minute here because I went to meet some of the workers who are going to build these homes to find out about these workforce challenges.
Here's our tour of the Ontario Masonry Training Center in Ottawa's East End.
So I get a good scoop of mortar, enough for the bed of my brick to lay in. From my last brick, I scraped off the excess, I scraped it off, and I put it onto the next brick following. Now I'm going to butter this brick.
It's called buttering?
Buttering. And then I take the...
Stefan Hamill is trying to up his game. The 41-year-old already has a job in construction. He's trying to learn some new tricks.
You'll never stop learning about masonry. There's always something to know, and I want to upgrade my skills and be a better bricklayer.
There are 8 level 1 masons right now, and they're laying up block walls, and they're facing them with a brick, as you can see.
It's about the size of the side of a small house, but only 5 feet tall.
Yeah, the length of the walls in this case are just so they can practice the technique.
Dave Mulcahy is the masonry instructor overseeing the 8 apprentices, all decked out in hard hats and safety goggles.
What do you love about masonry? What do you love about laying bricks?
Might sound strange. I could never be a cabinet maker. I would never have that precision. And yet with masonry, you can build something pretty beautiful. There's one thing that masonry has. I mean, it's obviously one of the oldest trades ever. But my work is going to be around for a long, long time. And you can't say that about too much.
How hard is it to find people who want to learn to be bricklayers?
This is my 46th year in the trade. I used to get calls every day, multiple calls, looking for masons. And I think that's throughout the industry, whether it be a plumber or electrician or anything like that. There's a real shortage of trades. The real difficulty here right now is, I think, generating interest in young people to want to get into the trades.
So what's the pitch then? If you were to encounter a young person and say, okay, become a mason, how do you sell them on the idea?
To me right now, I mean, everything sort of seems to be money. If you were to start today, there's a very, very real chance in about 4 years you could be making 6 figures a year.
Wow.
This is a very lucrative business. They're in demand right now. They can expect to be employed all year long for a long time to come.
But despite the potential for good pay, the housing crunch means even apprentice bricklayers like Stefan Hamill don't see themselves being able to buy a home anytime soon.
I don't see any opportunity to buy a house for as hard as you work that all the money doesn't go anywhere, definitely not to savings. I don't see enough houses being built to supply all the people that are here. I don't see anything good coming from it. If there's enough guys to come into the trades, then maybe that'd make a difference, but that's not happening either.
Another apprentice, Declan Hilton, agrees.
There's just not enough people. Like, our class is 8. There's really nobody out there that's willing to do the hard labor anymore. And I know a lot of laborers are leaving their jobs now because of working conditions are so tough because there's such a rush to get everything out. So it's taking a bit of a hit right now, for sure.
Instructor Dave Mulcahy points out the aging workforce is having a big impact too.
I'm 65 this year and I see all my buddies are retiring. I'm trying to get myself into retirement here, but a lot of people have a lot of work ahead of them, I think. I don't know if anyone's figured out why young people don't want to do this type of work or don't want to get into the trades. There has to be a reason.
If you could say anything to the federal housing minister, is there a question you would ask him or is there something you'd want to express to him?
I'm sure there's lots, but 2 words, good luck.
Good luck, he says. Minister, what do you say to Dave?
Look, I've always been a believer that you create your own luck by doing the work. First of all, thanks, Dave, for the work that you do. We need more people like you if we're going to solve the housing crisis. You know, it's fascinating. You started with provincial-federal relations, and now we're talking about the workforce development challenges that we're going to face. These, in my mind, are the two biggest challenges that we need to overcome if we're going to solve the housing crisis. We're going to put financial incentives in place. We're going to work with cities to adopt new zoning practices. We're going to work with provinces to have the right policies in place. But we're going to hit a new ceiling of productivity that we need to achieve if we're going to meet the very ambitious goals we set based on the capacity of the workforce to produce the homes that we need. We're not just hoping. We're not just wishing for luck. We're putting money on the table to dramatically ramp up training for people in the skilled trades. We're going to be launching efforts to recruit more young people into the trades. We're putting more money on the table specifically for foreign credential recognition for people who are here now that have the skills but not the qualifications to do the jobs we need them to do. But even if we ramp up the Canadian home building workforce, we're still not going to be able to achieve our full potential. We need to pivot in some ways the way that we build homes by incentivizing more manufacturing and factory settings where you can work at the same pace through the winter as you can during the construction season, where you can put multiple shifts through the day and get more done.
So just to be clear, Minister, I mean, we were just talking about in that item how the estimates range from upwards of 500,000 to upwards of 1 million construction workers that are going to be needed to be hired or brought in through immigration over the course of the next few years. It sounds to me like what you're saying is that just can't be done. It's also going to have to come through the means of how things are done. We just aren't going to be able to find that many people. Is that right?
We have to do both. We have to ramp up the number of people who are trained domestically. We have to use targeted immigration programs to supplement the skills deficit that exists in the Canadian economy today. And we have to recruit more people into the sector, no question. And we also have to deal with interprovincial trade barriers to make it easier for somebody in my home province in Nova Scotia to work in Alberta. But we also have to change the way we build homes. There is an enormous opportunity by putting funding on the table and also by creating a pipeline of orders, working across levels of government to deliver consistency that will allow factories to scale up. But factories today can offer cost competitive rates when it comes to home building, but they can produce twice as fast in some instances as a traditional stick-built home would allow you to move forward with or a small apartment building. If we incentivize the ramping up of factory-built homes, we can dramatically increase the pace of home building, and we need to operate, or rather offer, cost-effective and labor-efficient designs as part of the process, which is where the National Home Design Catalog comes in.
Pierre Poilievre often criticizes you for spending all this money, millions on the housing accelerators, without having an actual home built yet. I know the pitch with this strategy is almost 3.9 million new homes by 2031. But people listening are going to say, you know, how long is it going to take before we start to see a real difference? Hundreds of thousands of homes built, for instance. When can you say to Canadians, okay, we're making a dent?
Well, it's ironic because there are hundreds of thousands of homes that have already received the support, either through repairs or new builds from the National Housing Strategy before the release of the plan today. So it's disingenuous for somebody to suggest that there haven't been homes built when actually hundreds of thousands have. I'm not asking people to believe in a promise. I actually think a dose of skepticism is a healthy thing in democracy. I'm asking people to believe in a plan that we publish with concrete measures that are going to work. And we know they're going to work because we're borrowing these ideas from communities that are already implementing and experiencing success as a result of putting these changes in place. So you don't have to take it from me. Look at the plan. Consider the value of the measures yourself and ask yourself, what more could we do? Are there other ideas? Because we're willing to do more if we need to. But this is the most comprehensive set of housing policies that have been released in certainly in decades, perhaps in Canada's history, that's going to help solve the housing crisis. I'm not interested in playing around the margins. I want to solve the housing crisis. And if we bring different levels of the government, the private sector, and nonprofits along with us, we can get the job done.
Housing Minister Sean Fraser, thank you very much for your time.
A pleasure, as always. Thanks for having me.
Lots more coming up on the House podcast, including former British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has urged Canadian Conservatives to lean in on a climate plan. So, will they? I'm Catherine Cullen. You're listening to Canada's most popular political affairs program. A new episode of The House drops every Saturday. Let us know what you think about what you hear. You can send us an email at thehouse@cbc.ca.
Intelligence is a very sophisticated approach. We are a learning organization, so we are all trying to get better. But also would like to say that I'm extremely proud of the work that the intelligence professional of CSIS do every day in Canada and around the world in very dangerous situations to protect Canadians and make sure that we are safe, secure, and a prosperous country.
That's CSIS Director David Vigneault in front of the public inquiry into foreign interference this week, defending Canada's spy service. In a surprising twist, on Friday, Vigneault was called back in front of the committee to answer more questions about what he said to the Prime Minister. Multiple witnesses had raised questions about whether key information was missing from some security briefings. Dick Fadden is the former head of Canada's spy agency. He also held the role of national security and intelligence advisor to both Prime Ministers Harper and Trudeau. I asked him whether he thought all the key pieces of information were being communicated to the PM and his team.
I think that's a very good question and a very difficult one to answer, because I think in all of this, people sometimes underestimate how busy prime ministers are. They are pulled in any number of directions at the same moment, which is one of the reasons I think that officials, both in writing and verbally, tend to repeat the essential components of what they're trying to convey. I got the impression that in the final analysis, the information was conveyed to the Prime Minister's office and often to the Prime Minister. But the question that comes up in my mind is, if there are no immediate consequences in conveying this information, it doesn't become front of mind, certainly for the Prime Minister and maybe for his staff. Very different, for example, if CSIS is conveying information about terrorism. So did the Prime Minister and his staff, I think, get the essential messages? Yes. Did it take a while for them to register them? Because I think from their perspective, they were still in part of this period trying to promote good relations with China. Not to say they're ignoring it, but I do think it's fair to say that the government was, at least compared to our allies, relatively slow in coming to accept that we had a serious problem with FI.
I want to sort of dig in on one particular thing that we heard from the Prime Minister this week that's getting a lot of attention. The Conservatives, certainly Pierre Poilievre, has been making fun of what the Prime Minister had to say about his intelligence briefings. He said he doesn't always read everything that's put on his desk, and he relies on his national security advisor to brief him on important issues. Is that how the system is supposed to work?
Well, let me answer you by trying to refer back a little bit to history. I served three prime ministers in this role. One of them read everything, and God help you if you weren't well briefed and prepared to answer for every semicolon. Another one had a knack for focusing on important issues, which meant he didn't read absolutely everything. And a third one had did read things, but he had a preference for oral briefings. So I don't think this is extraordinary. And if you read about, presidents in the United States, they report the same things. Sometimes they read, sometimes they don't. My sort of conclusion to this is, if a NSA or NSIA or a clerk has something really important to tell the prime minister that may or may not be in writing, you organize a meeting, you stand in front of him, and you say, "Prime Minister, you must focus on this." You don't do that often because you lose credibility. But I don't think there's anything to be made fun of here. Mr. Trudeau, I think, is being honest when he says sometime he reads the stuff, sometime he listens to people. I think what's important in all of this is that if the system comes to the conclusion that given his preference for how to deal with national security issues, he's missing a certain point, they have to compensate. They have to find a way of going back and pushing.
Justin Trudeau's chief of staff, Katie Telford, said at a committee hearing last year that he reads every piece of intelligence that's put in front of him. I feel distinctly that you are not going to be able to tell us what was the case in your experience. I suppose I should ask you. You were his NSIA. Yeah.
Nobody knows what he does. He's in a closed office. Sometimes his EA gives him something. Sometimes it's his chief of staff. Sometimes it's the NSA. Sometimes it's the clerk. I would find it difficult to believe that he read every single piece of information fully. I used to work for a minister who would scribble on the top, read in part, skimmed. I think the reality of life is politicians are trained to go to the essential components of things. It's not for me to disagree with Ms. Telfer. She's in a better position than I am to know. But depending upon the volume of what he got from the NSIA, it's hard to believe that he sat down and he read from the very beginning to the very end.
So again, let's zoom out a bit, though, and talk about the broader significance here. It's not just the question of the reading, but there was also, it was clear this week, a sort of skepticism about the information that was being presented, not just to the Prime Minister, but to his team. And I wonder, that pushing, asking for more information, being skeptical about what's presented, Do you view that as a healthy skepticism or a sign of a concerning lack of trust?
I think it's a very good thing. And I would apply this skepticism or questioning to intelligence, to diplomatic reporting, to media reporting, and to what academics write. That isn't to say that you have to go into the chamber of intelligence receipt and question every single thing. It's a complicated world. It's a world where, because of the use of highly intrusive methods of collecting information, you can't always be as open as you might be on other topics. But, you know, Ms. Telfer and her colleagues were doing exactly what I used to do as NSA. I'd get information occasionally, sometimes for me, sometimes to kick upstairs, and I'd say, I don't understand this paragraph. Your title doesn't match the substance. I don't think I ever asked anybody to withdraw a piece of paper, but I certainly said to them, it's got to be clearer. So I think it's entirely reasonable for Ms. Telfer, for the NSA, for the clerk, or anybody else to question.
The thing that we have heard since before this inquiry started is this idea that intelligence is not evidence. I mean, we've heard it ad nauseum. Do you think that the information that has been presented to us as members of the public this week, do people sufficiently understand what intelligence is, what role it plays?
I'm not sure, because I think this argument this week about intelligence to evidence is not relevant. What the Prime Minister is being given is intelligence. He's being given information. Evidence is a concept required before the judicial system and before this commission. So if the standard required to present information to the Prime Minister is evidence, he wouldn't get a lot of information, because the standard, particularly in our criminal courts, is very, very high. So I think what you have to be is certain, particularly when you're briefing a Prime Minister, and particularly during an election, because everything is so volatile, you have to make sure that things are certain. But one of the characteristics, I think, of intelligence is there is a lot of gray. You're reporting on things where the people who are doing these things are doing their best to hide things. So one of my colleagues, Ward Elcock, told your colleague, David Cochrane, yesterday that to wait until you have, you know, absolute beautifully wrapped evidence slash information is too late. You have to bring people along. You have to tell them there's a potential problem over time. I don't know what they do today, but in my day at CSIS, we used to, generally speaking, in below intelligence, say we report this with low confidence, medium confidence, and high confidence. That's instead of saying during an oral briefing, you got to take this with a grain of salt.
The next step is seeing the first report from Justice Ugg. She has access to material that the general public doesn't. From what you know, do you think that the inquiry is answering the questions that needed to be answered?
I think so, but I also think that the justice, the commissioner, has to do some reconciling. She has to conclude whether the PMO and CSIS's and other people's perspective are correct. They are at variance with one another, and she, I think, has an important part of her job in sort of saying, you know, this perspective is fine. It's not wrong. It's not lying, but it's not the perspective that accurately describes things. But I do think there's enough there, both in writing and orally, for her to do that.
Thank you for your time today.
My pleasure.
Dick Fadden is the former head of CSIS. Conservatives from across the country and the world were in Ottawa this week sharing ideas at the Canada Strong and Free Conference, including former British Prime Minister Boris Johnson and former Australian PM Tony Abbott. On a panel Wednesday, the two shared some pretty different ideas about climate change.
As Conservatives, I don't think that we can afford simply to say to the public, to young people who really care about this, that we're junking the whole agenda. Because let me tell you, elections are won by the party that really owns the future. People want to see that there's a plan and a program to deal with this problem in a proper conservative way.
We should try to reduce emissions as far and as fast as we can.
I think we agree.
But not if it means big job losses, the end of manufacturing industry in this country, and massive attacks on people's cost of living. And can I tell you, I won a thumping majority fighting on this policy.
Also speaking at the event, Premiers Danielle Smith, Blaine Higgs, and Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre. The event used to be known as the Manning Conference. It's a chance for conservatives to network and showcase a range of policy ideas. Could any of them be adopted by a future Polyev government? Joining me are two journalists who were at the conference. Campbell Clark is a columnist for the Globe and Mail. He was there to cover the event. Jen Gerson is co-founder of the online publication The Line. She was a panelist at the conference. Thank you both for being here in studio with me.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Campbell, this isn't an official Conservative Party event. How much, though, does it tell us about what is happening in the Conservative movement in Canada?
I think it tells us a fair bit about how the sort of thought leaders in the Conservative movement are looking at things. And I think you could see from this event that they're thinking about what they're going to do when they're in power. And that was what they were all expectant. They're all watching, talking about where do we go? What are we going to do? What are we going to change? And that was the whole mood of the excitement of we're going to change things was all around.
Jen, I watched your panel. There was a pretty, we'll call it a lively exchange of ideas, some differences of opinion. I wonder overall, how broad is the range of perspectives at this event?
That's an interesting question. I do think there's probably a broader range of perspectives than you might imagine. It is always and always has been, I think, a big tent party that if not necessarily welcomes different ranges of perspectives, but I certainly was on that stage and I made some unpopular opinions that I knew were going to be unpopular.
Well, people are going to want to know if they're listening. One unpopular opinion you have.
Oh, put it this way. I said that we shouldn't defund the CBC, for example. I made that case and I continued to make that case in Hospitality Suites. And I think there's a conservative case for the CBC that they are potentially not considering because there's a lot of deep-seated antipathy toward the CBC among a lot of these people.
Campbell, we just heard a moment ago the voices of Boris Johnson and Tony Abbott on climate change. Does the difference between those two leaders mirror a split in the conservative movement here in Canada? Or do you think that there's unity when it comes to this question of how to address climate change?
I think there was, at least at this conference, there's more unity than split. You know, you heard that clip, and I would say people were talking about it the next day and saying, like yesterday, and saying, Boris Johnson was more entertaining, but if you're talking about climate change, they were agreeing more with Tony Abbott. But overall, what you heard was more, we should not be trying to reduce emissions in any way that would conflict with jobs. There was very much an interest in, we have to get the energy sector back moving, revive the energy sector, revive the oil and gas sector, get it producing again. And the net zero goals, the emissions reductions goals are getting in the way of that. So there was certainly more of the Tony Abbott side of things than the Boris Johnson, we have to come up with a plan for climate change.
Jen, what's your take?
I think that that's broadly correct. I think Abbott is the mentality that's winning the day. And I do think there's a great deal of unity, especially on the consumer-facing carbon tax. Bluntly, I think that that's doomed. I don't think there's any reviving that or resurrecting that in the current conservative movement as it's formed today.
Can I ask you, when you say you think the Abbott perspective is winning the day, I mean, he is a climate skeptic, certainly. Mm-hmm. Do you think that that means that in the conservative movement in Canada, there's a real skepticism about trying to, say, hit the Paris targets?
Oh, yeah. But I mean, I think that if you operate in Canada under any ideological spectrum, you should have some skepticism about our ability to hit the Paris targets. So I don't necessarily think that there's as much climate skepticism as people like to portray. I think that there's more of a skepticism about policy approaches. I don't necessarily think that everybody in the room is a climate change denier. And in fact, I think there is an agreement that some stuff needs to be done. Where I do think the skepticism is very deeply rooted and almost universal is the idea that these policies will be effective at dealing with this problem, or that anything Canada could do would be effective at dealing with this problem.
There were some climate deniers on the stage, right? Yeah. There was Global Warming Policy Forum, which is a British-based, and they're the American Friends of GWPF, yep, are essentially people that believe that climate change is not man-made climate change is not a serious issue and we shouldn't be wasting our time trying to combat it.
I'm not a climate change denier.
I shouldn't, yeah. So, but I'm not saying that those people were the only people speaking out, but there certainly was a very strong feeling of, if this is a problem, it should be dealt with by China, or it should be dealt with in ways that allow us to develop our industries, and there should be a way of accounting for this that is dealt with abroad.
Which is a position you hear from, conservative premiers.
From Blaine
in this.
Higgs,
yes,
as
exactly.
You did yesterday.
I do want to take a little bit of a detour here when we're talking about climate policy and talk about the NDP for a moment, who are having their own conference just on the other side of downtown, the Broadbent Conference. And NDP leader Jagmeet Singh gave a speech there where he made some comments about the consumer carbon tax that are getting a lot of attention. People are wondering, the Toronto Star headline was that he was backpedaling. Is he distancing himself from the Liberals' carbon tax? Let's listen.
It can't be done by letting working people by letting working families bear the cost of climate change while big polluters make bigger and bigger profits.
Now, I spoke to the NDP after Singh's speech, and I tried to pin down whether they're dropping their support for the consumer carbon tax. They won't say that they're dropping their support. They will not say to me that they still support it either. They do say the NDP is working on its own plan, so it's sort of like, watch this space, stay tuned. Jen, what do you think this means for the future of the consumer carbon tax in Canada? I mean, you hinted.
It's very doomed.
But well, the NDP specifically, if that piece falls away, how does that play out?
So what I thought was hilarious when I heard that, it seems to me almost as if the NDP had read my last column on the carbon tax.
Maybe
because one
did.
Of the things that I specifically said in this is that if you want to maintain something resembling a carbon tax or a climate policy, the first step in that is admitting defeat and to admit that the consumer-facing side of the carbon tax is probably toast. You're in a house that's burning down before your eyes. So you have the first step in this process is to save the furniture. And what's one of the pieces of furniture? It would be a carbon tax on industrial emitters and heavy emitters. Focus right now on industrial emitters, heavy emitters. And what I think is interesting about that is that it wouldn't surprise me in the least if that were a policy that was more or less paralleled by the Conservatives.
Campbell, I want to bring you in here, though, to talk party politics for a second here at the NDP. If indeed the NDP is in some way, shape, or form, it feels like they're, I don't know, is it a full back pedal? Is it a half a step back? I don't know. But if they're making some movement on this issue and we see that their poll numbers are low and we see that they are losing MPs who say they're not going to run again, I mean, what does that change tell us about the NDP?
It tells us a lot about the NDP. Like, they are backpedaling. Yes, they are. They can only backpedal so fast so far in the first couple of days, and they don't want to take it too far. But that's what they're doing. And I don't think they're trying to save the industrial output-based carbon pricing. I think they're trying to get away from the consumer fuel charge and as fast as they can. And, you know, I think the reason is pretty obvious that in a lot of places they run races in ridings that are conservative NDP mostly. And when the Liberals go down, that actually makes those races more competitive. And they're getting, Jagmeet Singh and the people around him are getting beaten up by people in their caucus and their party that are facing that kind of race saying, why are we hanging ourselves with a Liberal policy or with Liberal policies generally? Of course, it would have been a lot better if they had ditched the Liberal policy years before they, you know, stood by it.
The Conservatives are pointing out it was just about 3 weeks ago that they supported or voted against a motion to not have a rise.
Yeah, you don't have to have a crack research team to find the instances where the NDP supported the consumer carbon tax. It's been going on for a long time. But clearly they have adopted sort of the language of the Conservative Party in talking about how this is going to affect ordinary folks. They seem to be saying we should be taking more regulatory methods, which I don't think is really in line with the Conservatives. But anyway, the point is the NDP are dying first in the places where they have support, and that's where they face Conservatives. And they're not picking it up where they face Liberals, at least not in a sort of verifiable way. It's a really serious problem for them, and they're running hard back from where they were.
Okay, I do want to leave this where we started, which is the question of the Conservatives. And it wasn't just climate change. They talked about, you know, immigration, gender policies, a whole range of issues. Jen, do you think what was being discussed, or what do you think of what was being discussed at this conference might tell us something about where Pierre Poilievre is headed?
Yeah. If I were to sum it up succinctly and broadly, I would say immigration, I would say childcare policy and childcare issues are going to be an issue. And the other thing I would say is cultural policy would be where I would go. Not to come back to my own panel, but I fully do expect the Conservatives to make good on their promises to repeal various subsidies to media and potentially even to defund the CBC in some form. I don't think that those are false promises. I think that they're going to come into power, if they do come into power, with a very strong mandate to move forward on a lot of these files, and I suspect they will.
Campbell?
Yeah, I think that's true. You know, the defund the CBC gets a lot of applause. So does all of the things that you were mentioning about internet regulation. You know, all of those cultural policy things are things that they are going to follow up on in serious ways. But they bring back the resource sector, and making things and exporting our resources is not a small part of what was going on here. And I think that that is going to be part of what they are making their priorities.
Thank you both for this discussion. It's great to have you both in studio. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Globe columnist Campbell Clark and Jen Gerson, co-founder of The Line.
Okay, that's it for us this week. Our crew on the House is Kristen Everson, Emma Godmere, Christian Fosslang, and our senior producer is Jennifer Chevalier. I am Catherine Cullen. Thank you so much for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.